Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. Welcome to Vermont Viewpoint. Jim Douglas sitting in today for Rick, and we wish him all the best on taking a day off. I assume he's taking the day off because it's Thomas Jefferson's birthday. Is that a state holiday? I can't remember. But the third president of the United States, born 278 years ago today, a great legacy and perhaps a topic of discussion on another show, but not today. We've got other business to tend to, and I want to get right to it. We're going to talk this morning with four members of Governor Phil Scott's cabinet about the ARPA, which is the American Recovery Plan Act that was approved by Congress recently, a huge glob of money that's going around the country and more than $1 billion coming to Vermont. And a big chunk of it is in the area of responsibility of our first guest, Secretary Julie Moore of the Agency of Natural Resources. And it's a real pleasure and honor to welcome Secretary Moore to the show this morning. Hi, Julie.
Good morning, Governor Douglas.
Well, thanks
so
much. Well, I'm doing great. Of course, I don't have any responsibility now. You do. And we're glad you're there. A long time dedicated public servant who now has an important responsibility for our state, and you're doing a great job there, Julie. And now we've got an additional task for you, thanks to the Congress and the governor's plan, and that's the fact that more than a third, I guess, of this $1 billion is coming to areas within your field of responsibility. So I'm very interested in learning about it, and I know the folks around the state who are listening this morning are too. So we're talking about infrastructure, water and sewer projects that a lot of our communities want to pursue, and some climate change related projects as well. So give us a sense of how you plan to deploy the hundreds of millions of dollars that you'll be responsible for.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So as you noted, there is just about $1 billion in fairly flexible federal money that is slated to come to Vermont and is available for investments in critical infrastructure, as well as counteracting the negative economic impacts associated with the COVID-19 pandemic. And so that gives us quite a bit of latitude in thinking about how we can best invest these dollars to help bring Vermont forward as we sort of emerge from the pandemic and look to get back to normal, but also provide a robust foundation for our state as a whole going forward. And as you noted, the governor has proposed about $170 million worth of investments in water and sewer infrastructure, $200 million worth of investments in climate change mitigation and resilience work, and then maybe a smaller bucket, but one that's also really important to the agency, is there's $25 or $30 million proposed for continued work around outdoor recreation and making investments in both state lands as well as private lands, knowing that outdoor recreation really took off during the pandemic, and we're looking to continue to support and grow that important component of Vermont's economy. But if you'd like, I'm happy to dive a little bit further into maybe the water infrastructure investments first.
Yeah, let's dive into the water, so to speak. Take it away.
So of that $170 million, just a little less than half is actually proposed for work related to improving stormwater management. And it goes into sort of three broad categories. One is related to what we call the 3-acre stormwater permit. This was a permit we agreed to with EPA as part of the settlement around the Lake Champlain total maximum daily load, which is the pollution budget looking at phosphorus levels in Lake Champlain. And we have to do quite a bit of stormwater work to try to drive down those phosphorus levels, which in turn should prevent the harmful algal blooms that can close beaches along the lakefront throughout the summer. So this money will help us get well underway with the implementation of that 3-acre stormwater permit that affects roughly 700 properties throughout the Lake Champlain Basin. And in addition, it allows us to accelerate our work dealing with stormwater runoff from municipal roads and state highways. This is work where every municipality in the state is underway at this point in helping address stormwater runoff from town roads. And we believe these dollars can help accelerate that work. And then finally, there are a handful of communities that have what's called stormwater impaired waters, where there's too much water in a small stream immediately following a rainfall event. Communities from St. Albans to Burlington to Rutland have developed what are called flow restoration plans, looking to help keep those peaks down, and again believe that these dollars will help accelerate the implementation of those flow restoration plans.
Well, I remember when you were with the agency before doing a lot of great work on this problem, and then we had that excessive flooding in the spring of 2011 that kind of set us back more than a little bit. So I'm glad you're on the case again. Julie, how will you prioritize these projects?
So the hope or the plan is to be able to offer sort of engineering and permitting design services to any parcel owner who is subject to the 3-acre permit to help them understand just what's needed on their particular property. And then we've provided 10 years for folks to be able to implement the retrofit projects needed to manage the stormwater. But the idea being with these federal dollars, we're hoping we can incentivize people to move sooner. We recognize not everyone may be willing or able to move in the next 3 years, and that is one limitation on this money is it all needs to be expended by the end of calendar year 2024. So it does put a pretty important sideboard on the types of projects we're looking at and frankly just the amount of the work we think is realistic to complete between now and the end of 24.
Now, how will this work? The governor's got a budget proposal, obviously, on an annual basis or even more than annual during this pandemic. Will this be worked into his budget? Is it a separate piece of legislation? How will it work?
I think that's still an area of active discussion with the General Assembly. As you may know, that the House did program some of what they are anticipating to be these state dollars as part of the budget that they have already voted and passed over to the Senate. I know that the Finance and Management Department is currently working on putting together a draft bill that would speak to all of these different investments that the governor has proposed. And it's not yet clear if that would be taken up as a separate standalone bill or integrated into the FY22 state budget. Of the $1 billion that's available for the next 3 or 3.5 years, the governor's proposal would see about 370 to 380 million of it invested during the fiscal 22 year, so starting July 1st through June 30th of next year.
We're chatting with Julie Moore, the Secretary of Natural Resources, about how her agency will deploy some of the new federal dollars coming in through the Recovery Act passed by the Congress. Let's talk, Julie, about water systems and wastewater, very important to a lot of our communities. What's the plan there?
It is. And as a civil engineer, this is work that's truly near and dear to my heart. But we have here in Vermont, we have more than 150 village centers that don't have any community scale drinking water or wastewater systems. And as folks look to reinvest in those downtown areas and do things like redevelop general stores to maybe include a small dining area or create accessory dwelling units within their home, those projects can often be challenged and potentially limited by the availability of wastewater and drinking water capacity. And so the governor's budget includes $35 million for what we're calling village water and wastewater investments. These are unlikely to take the form of sort of the traditional wastewater treatment facility you might think of in Vermont's larger communities, the Burlingtons and St. Albans and St. Johnsburys of the world. But instead would likely be a soil-based disposal system, sort of a bigger version of what many Vermonters have in their backyards is a leach field that could actually handle wastewater from any number of buildings. The governor and I, prior to the pandemic, had the good fortune to visit the Brownsville General Store down by Manuscutney, which is a great example of this. A young couple had purchased the general store, sought to redevelop it, including providing a cafe area, and ultimately pursued a community-scale wastewater solution that I believe involved the fire department and a couple of other local buildings, allowed them to create this sort of community hub within the Brownsville area, as well as create some additional capacity for future residents or businesses that also may wish to join in that area. We've had a lot of interest in this, but the financing has always been a challenge. It's sort of a non-traditional use compared to the types of programs we have, which really envision lots of concrete and steel. So we're very excited about the opportunities these present for maintaining Vermont's kind of compact settlement patterns and vibrant village centers.
Well, I know through your work at the Council on Rural Development, you're well aware of many communities across the state that have an urgent need for this sort of investment. And we're going to be talking later in the show with Secretary Curley about, among other things, the governor's priority of affordable housing. And a lot of these communities would like to build some affordable homes, but they need the water and sewer infrastructure, right?
Correct. They go hand in hand with one another, and it is really essential. I think of water and sewer infrastructure as foundational to any of these decisions. One of the stories I'm fond of is the town of Montgomery, which did go through the local planning process with the Vermont Council on Rural Development, and they had identified a number of economic development and revitalization initiatives that they wished to pursue. And very quickly came to realize that without first looking to invest in water and sewer infrastructure, that none of those were likely to be able to come to fruition.
And I've heard that some of these investments are likely to help our agricultural sector. Is that right?
They are. Another important piece of this same bucket is looking at pretreatment programs. And pretreatment is usually work done by a business before they discharge into a community wastewater system. And some of Vermont's best products and best industries produce really rich waste, breweries and distilleries, but also meat and dairy processing facilities. And we know that the ability to install pretreatment is often a precursor to expansion that folks are looking to do because their community simply isn't in a position to support the wastewater that they would be generating absent a pretreatment process. And so some of these dollars will be used to make those very kinds of investments as well.
I think you've got the attention of a lot of our listeners. We've got to keep those breweries and distilleries strong and going well. Julie, we've got a call from Stephen in Montpelier. Let's ask what's on his mind this morning. Go ahead.
Good morning, Governor and Julie. In 1987, I helped start the Vermont Basin Planning Program, and this was just to begin kind of a holistic point and non-point source conservation of wastewater and agricultural runoff program. And I think that's been quite successful over the years. I think it's now extended to all the basins in Vermont. And then later on, I started the Vermont Wetland Protection Program in 1993 with Steve Reines and Bill Countryman and a bunch of other folks. And I think that's also helped protect waters.
Julie?
Very much so. Those remain integral components to our overall work around water quality. It's nice to hear from you, Stephen. In particular, the basin planning process is a key component of organizing our work to implement the Lake Champlain TMDL, as well as to help protect existing high-quality waters and make sure that they stay in that condition. And our wetlands regulatory work, as well as the efforts we've placed on wetlands protection and conservation, taken together, are sort of nature sponge in helping absorb stormwater runoff, provide a degree of treatment for that runoff, and also excellent habitat for many, many of the wildlife and flora that call Vermont home. So all incredibly important efforts to this larger book of work around environmental protection.
Yeah, a lot of folks have worked very hard for a long time, and we certainly appreciate that. Secretary Moore, we want to talk about the other major focus of the ARPA funds that are coming to your agency, and that deals with climate resiliency. There are a number of initiatives that the governor outlined, and I'm sure our listeners would be interested in hearing about them.
Sure. At the highest level, the investments around climate change sort of fall into two buckets, one of which I've been referring to as no regrets policies, and I'll come back to those in a bit more detail in a minute. And then the other is setting aside and reserving $100 million to support the initial implementation of Vermont's Climate Action Plan. As folks may be aware, last session, the legislature placed into law the Global Warming Solutions Act, which created the Vermont Climate Council and charged it with developing a plan, the Climate Action Plan, to meet greenhouse gas emissions reduction requirements with dates established for 2025, 2030, and 2050. The council is hard at work. I serve on the council in my capacity as ANR secretary as one of 23 members. And we are working like the Dickens to produce this climate action plan and have it ready by the December 1st statutory deadline. And so holding $100 million to support implementation of the recommendations of that plan is really exciting, and I think gives a big sense of purpose to the work of the Climate Council. In addition, though, you know, there's work we can do in the interim, and that's really where these no regrets policies come in. These are things we know we're going to have to do regardless of the final recommendations contained in the Climate Action Plan, and they include investments in electric vehicle charging infrastructure, ongoing efforts around weatherization, particularly with focusing on lower-income Vermonters' homes, electrification incentives, so helping people make the switch from fossil fuel-driven heating and cooling systems to all-electric or modern wood systems, as well as starting to implement some of the highest priority recommendations from the Vermont's 2018 Hazard Mitigation Plan. And this looks at the resilience of our landscape. And in particular, we know that there are a number of homes and businesses throughout Vermont that have, on more than one occasion, experienced flood-related impacts, but still weren't eligible for buyout assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA. And so creating a state-level hazard mitigation buyout program to help move those homeowners and businesses to higher ground in a way that they can survive economically is really important as well. And so the governor has included that in this set of no regrets policies.
Well, that'll be great. I've seen some of the news reports of those homes that are sliding into a stream or suffering other kinds of flood-related damage, and they don't have the same access that others do. Sounds good. We're talking with Julie Moore, the Secretary of Natural Resources, and so there's a big push for weatherization, and we saw in the news recently the city of Burlington is talking about mandating weatherization for all the rental properties in the city, but it's obviously a good idea. Dorothy and I weatherized our home and cut our costs there, and so how is this going to work? Through the Agency of Human Services, where some of these programs have been run?
Yes, they are obviously sort of the lead in a lot of this, the Office of Economic Opportunity within the Agency of Human Services. And the weatherization proposal with the ARPA funds builds on recommendations the governor made, given some one-time monies that were available in the FY22 budget. So in the FY22 budget, base budget, he proposed $25 million worth of investments, both through the Office of Economic Opportunity, which really works with lower-income Vermonters, as well as the Vermont Housing Finance Agency, to help put together a revolving loan program with some amount of loan forgiveness for moderate-income Vermonters. This additional increment of funding through ARPA, the governor's proposed another $21 million, so a total $46 million investment would allow us to sort of maintain the accelerated pace we were looking at for fiscal 22 through the end of fiscal 24. We're sure that that work is likely to continue beyond 24 under the auspices of the Climate Action Plan, but also know that it's really important to the partner agencies that are so integral to doing this work that they can see that there's several years of consistent funding in line, and it allows them to plan their workforce around it.
And, Julie, there's a lot of interest in electric vehicles, of course, not only in Vermont but around the country. We've got a few hundred charging stations, I guess, now. But in a rural state like ours, can we really have enough of them everywhere so that people can get into electric vehicles in a significant way?
We do think so. But it's an investment that needs to be made over time. We have, by last count, I think 292 publicly accessible charging stations. So that's not counting what folks may have at their own home in their garage. And we're looking to add to that number by about 50% again with the $25 million commitment here. These stations would be targeted to state facilities, including some locations along state highways with those fast charge equipment, as well as multifamily housing units and businesses. Places where you have a greater pool of vehicles, so to speak, that may wish to tap into the EV infrastructure. And we know this is a place we're going to need to continue to invest over time to ensure that folks don't have that range fear that some claim plagues people and when they're considering an electric vehicle purchase, and know that there will be charging infrastructure generally available to them as they travel throughout Vermont.
Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people are thinking, I don't want to get stuck in Ferdinand or Avery's Gore without any power from my car. So that's
exactly
good. You mentioned when we started the conversation that there's another component. It's not huge, but I think will be of interest to listeners, and that's recreation-related investments. Can you talk a little about that?
Yes. So the governor's budget does include $25 million for the outdoor recreation economy, and that may come up a little bit later with Secretary Curley because it's actually part of that economic recovery package that mm-hmm. she's championing. Mm-hmm. But it includes work through our VOREC program, which is the Vermont Outdoor Recreation Economic Collaborative. This is a program that Governor Scott initiated during the first year of his time in office. But it's really focused on growing the outdoor recreation economy. We've run a very successful grant program, which encourages communities to apply for resources to help build out recreational amenities. And we're looking at a dramatic expansion of that VOREC grant program, as well as making some strategic investments across public and private lands in things like trails and fishing access areas, paddler access, and other recreational access assets. Excuse me. We've seen a dramatic increase in usage over the last year in terms of people getting out and seeing what Vermont has to offer. Lots of first-time hikers, new anglers. Our fishing license sales this year were up by over 40%. It's a really incredible story. And to my mind, is hopefully one of the silver linings of the COVID cloud is helping people see all of the incredible opportunities that exist in Vermont to get outside.
And for people want to get out after this pandemic, that's for sure. But Julie Moore, Secretary of the Agency of Natural Resources, thanks so much for being with us on Vermont Viewpoint this morning.
Thank you for having me, Governor. Nice to talk with you.
Great to chat with you, and best of luck in implementing this important program. We'll be right back.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings, and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren's Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrensStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Jim Douglas sitting in today. Thanks for tuning in, spending a little of your morning with us. We're talking with four members of Governor Phil Scott's cabinet today about the implementation of the American Recovery Plan Act that was approved by Congress, the latest multi-trillion-dollar stimulus package. But we're going to take a little detour during this segment to talk about another topic that's really important to a lot of Vermonters, a lot of families, a lot of young people, and that's our plan to get everybody back in the classroom as quickly as possible. And we're joined by Dan French, the Secretary of the Agency of Education, who's a point person on moving forward on this important initiative. And we appreciate, Mr. Secretary, your spending time with us this morning.
Oh, good morning, Governor. Good to talk to you.
Well, I guess the question is fairly basic. When are all of our kids going to be back in school?
Yeah, hopefully as soon as possible. You know, it's been a lot of work this year, and, you know, our school districts have had to navigate a sort of a roller coaster in terms of the conditions. And we certainly are expecting conditions to improve pretty significantly with the advent of more vaccine. But, you know, there's been a lot of activity lately. So, you know, our school districts are struggling the last couple of weeks to keep their operations going. But I'm still very optimistic that with more vaccine and the warmer weather and so forth and the opportunity to use outdoor activities that are we'll see schools return to more in person before the end of the school year.
And one change, I suppose, that is helpful is the CDC's new guidelines suggesting that the space between students need only be 3 feet instead of six. That should help.
Yeah, we made that update to their guidance a couple of weeks ago. You know, we've been working on it for a while when the CDC, as you mentioned, made that change. It just, I think it points to, you know, just we know so much more about the virus now than we did last year. And certainly we had the experience of other countries in Europe in particular that are operating at 3 feet. And we have our own experience. You know, Vermont has had 3 feet as a distance requirement for elementary students since the fall. So we were pleased to be able to make that adjustment. Again, it all has to be done in an understanding of our conditions in Vermont and what we can safely do. But we also have confidence that districts can implement that type of standards. And that's an important consideration in any change that we do to our guidance.
So you think there is enough room in the classrooms around Vermont to accommodate the 3 foot distance?
Yeah, it's going to vary. I'm thinking more at the elementary level that it's possible. You might remember your days in school that elementary school is organized around classes. Generally speaking, you know, you have one teacher teaching a class with multiple subjects being taught in the same room. And that sort of podding, we call it from a CDC COVID experience term, is more doable at the elementary level. At the high school, we tend to have courses, not classes. So we have students moving around. They tend to be mixed more among grade levels, so the podding piece is a little more difficult to achieve. So I think a lot of our high schools will have to really do some more intensive planning around the 3 feet, but I'm hopeful that most of our elementary schools will make that transition more easily.
We're chatting with Dan French, the Secretary of Education, and you may know this, Dan, but we just got a media advisory from the governor's office moving today's COVID-19 response press conference from 11 a.m. to noon because the governor, Secretary of Human Services, Mike Smith, the Commissioner of Health, Dr. Levine, and others are going to have an 11 a.m. Phone call with governors and White House officials to talk about the news this morning regarding the Johnson & Johnson vaccine, the pause in rolling that out because of some side effects. So you have an extra hour to prepare for prepare for the press conference.
Yeah, it's been the nature of the beast. There's always new information, you know, and I think to your observation, you know, we work as a team and, you know, we're constantly processing new studies, new research, new governmental guidance. And, you know, this is just how it's been for the last year. So I know, you know, we've had the regular call on Tuesdays, the governor with other governors in the White House. So part of it's just sort of the normal schedule, but certainly new information on Johnson & Johnson and other information on vaccine supply will always an important consideration in the planning.
Well, I think Governor Scott's assembled a great team. You all seem to like each other. That's really important, too.
Yeah, it is really true. I mean, we work together really well. It makes my job a lot easier. You know, one day I was in a cabinet meeting and just considering that there hasn't been a single agency or department of state government that has not been involved in some way in supporting our K-12 schools. So it really has been an all hands on deck, you know, to support our communities and our schools. It's been great.
Well, Dan, since I brought up the Johnson & Johnson vaccine pause this morning, will that affect the return to the classroom? I assume some of our teachers have received the J&J vaccine.
Yeah, I don't think there's any direct implications for those that have already been vaccinated. But I think, you know, there's always new information and new research behind the efficacy of these vaccines and so forth and their safety. And, you know, we'll consider that. I think it's more likely to impact our future decision-making because that's all predicated on an understanding of supply and so forth. And, you know, Vermont's been a state that always has been very proactive in terms of planning for our supply. So we schedule appointments when we have supply, not when we don't. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see how it impacts, if there is any impact at all on our planning for future vaccination, not so much for those that have already been vaccinated.
We're talking about getting kids back in the classroom, but in fact, a lot of kids have been in the classroom, right? What's the breakdown now? How many are going to school full-time? How many part-time? How many not at all?
Yeah, it's a great point. I mean, it's you hear a lot nationally now about schools that are reopening, and it's important to acknowledge that Vermont, like, you know, most New England states, has been open from the very beginning. And we've been somewhere around 80% of our students getting some form of, when we say hybrid instruction. So that can vary greatly, which is sort of the other challenge with coming up with a firm number. Folks define that differently, and our schools are moving in and out of different dispositions fairly regularly based on conditions or, and likely in Vermont also as a result of staffing issues, you know, logistics. So it varies, but we've been operating fairly consistently around that 80% mark in hybrid. I think it's fair to say that half of our elementary students are in person, have been pretty regularly. We have far fewer high school students experiencing full in person. But I think that's fairly consistent with what we see in other states who've been open all along. It's somewhere in that 75-80% mark in some form of hybrid instruction, and that, again, can vary 2 to 3 days a week, 4 days a week. 4 days a week seems to be a fairly common schedule among many schools in the state right now.
What other changes might there be in terms of the COVID protocol? I think I saw a report that temperature checking will be done at home rather than at the school to make it a little smoother. Any other changes in terms of the process?
I don't think so. You know, we've edited our guidance only three times. You know, the first time was in the summer prior to the opening of schools, and that was based on new operational information we were getting for school districts. And then we edited again in October based on new information we were receiving from studies and so forth, but also in anticipation of the holiday period and the winter, you know, being locked inside most of the winter. But, you know, this last edit, I think, will hopefully be our last. It's really based on the trajectory of vaccination and how we see conditions unfolding for the remaining part of the school year. I don't see the need to make additional edits unless we find out something really new from the scientific community. And I think, you know, what we were endeavoring to do this time around is not only to address new information relative to schools, but also to situate the guidance more closely with what we're calling the Vermont Forward Plan, so that there's a general understanding of how school guidance is situated in the broader context of reopening Vermont. So I don't anticipate any future changes to the guidance. We will be addressing some specific areas. So immediately right now we're going to be working on some guidance relative to graduation and end of school year celebrations for schools. So we want to do what we can to enable those to happen and try to get that information out sooner rather than later so districts can do their planning. And we're working on specific issues related to summer school and so forth.
We're chatting with Dan French, the Secretary of Education, about reopening all of our schools. And I saw quotes earlier in the week by the teachers union, and I'm interested in your reaction to some of them. They say teachers want to get back in school, but we've got to see more science. We've got to see if we're going to be inside or outside, what the tents look like. We've got to see if there's enough spacing. We've got to see if the schedule works. Are there still roadblocks that they're raising to make this happen so we can get all our kids back to school?
Yeah, I think, well, there's definitely, you know, firstly, a lot of fatigue among school staff. I mean, it's been a long year for sure. And there's, you know, there's a lot of concern as a teacher. You also have to be concerned about the behavior of your students and parents when they're not in school. And, you know, all those factors in a pandemic come to play. But I think, you know, that sort of combination of fatigue and anxiety is still very real. However, I think, you know, we've also, you know, we've done really, I think, as much as we can from a policy perspective to really enact safe working conditions for our students. I mean, and I think Vermont's data bears that out. I think you'd be hard-pressed to find a state that has had a better performance relative to its K-12 system during the pandemic. And our folks have really stepped up and done a great job in terms of monitoring very challenging dynamic, to say the least. You know, and we've also sort of we made some really proactive steps in trying to get school staff vaccinated, and that was, I think, very successful. We have, we think, over 80% of school staff are vaccinated at this point. And certainly, you know, with the recent change in the guidance and what have you, I think, you know, we're the guidance pieces are all there. So we really, we just want folks to focus on, you know, ending the year in a positive way, you know, trying to focus on the needs of students as best we can, which is always, you know, paramount in educators' minds at any rate. But, you know, sort of that balancing act of how to bring that together. And, you know, schools are, you know, Vermont schools in particular are deeply embedded in their community. So a lot of that conversation about, you know, are schools safe, should students be in school, plays out at the local level. Mm-hmm. And we see differences in those community conversations. There are communities with large groups of parents who are like, you know, I want to have remote option for my student. It's worked out well. We have others that are more adamant about getting the kids back in the building. So all those things have to be sort of played out in Vermont. I know you're familiar with those local control dynamics.
You bet.
Yeah.
You bet.
But I think, you know, yeah, the general, the comment, and we've seen, I mean, just look at the data. I mean, schools have operated very safely in Vermont. And we continue to be, you know, proud of that accomplishment and supportive of our workforce. They've done this really hard work.
Well, it hasn't been easy, has it? A lot of parents find themselves trying to juggle their own jobs with being a teacher to some degree at home as well. So I'm sure they're all looking forward to this.
And all that, you know, parents are, or teachers are parents too. But all that sort of anxiety, you know, our schools in Vermont are so closely connected to their community. So when there's that broader societal sort of anxiety, it does play out in the school community as well. They're not separate. But I think, you know, we're all in this together. And, you know, again, really proud of the work everyone's done. And we're gonna end the year in a positive way and put this behind us hopefully soon.
I sure hope so. And speaking of vaccines, older high school students will be eligible very soon, right?
Yeah, that's really positive news. You know, hopefully we'll see that soon. So we'll able to start on a process of vaccinating our older students, and that'll play out really well at the high school level. So at least have one dose of the vaccine. I believe the Pfizer vaccine is the only one that's been authorized for 16-year-olds and up at this point. So yeah, that'll play out nicely with the remaining part of the school year and into the summer and so forth.
Well, I got the Pfizer vaccine. That means I'm at least 16.
So, well, good for you.
And, Dan, we've been talking about schools generically, but this deals with early education as well, doesn't it, pre-K and other programs?
Yeah, that's right. We have, you know, certainly a parallel sort of guidance structure and policy towards child care. It's one of, I think, one of the great accomplishments of Vermont. It was able to sustain a lot of its child care infrastructure in the early part of the pandemic, and I think that's going to serve us well going forward. Absolutely.
Yeah, I remember Secretary Mike Smith setting up those on a very short notice basis, child care options last year. So that's been helpful. I'm interested in some reports I've seen and heard from around the country, more than locally, about the so-called learning loss. I'm interested in your perspective on whether our kids have actually learned as much as they would have with this remote or semi-remote period, and whether we have a gap to plug going forward.
Yeah, it's a great question, and we know, you know, I think it's fair to say that those students that were struggling prior to the pandemic are probably struggling more. What we've done is put together what we're calling our recovery plan. So we are asking districts to go through a formal planning process that starts with a real needs assessment of the conditions of their district, and one of the areas we want them to assess is the academic situation of their students. So I think it's fair to say, on the one hand, we're not really sure. We know from some national data that some assessments, for example, that are often given nationally, and we've seen some trends from that data, you know, that show that younger students might have seen some loss in math in particular, or skill-based areas of instruction, but it's unclear. So I think, you know, first thing is we want districts to do that assessment, and we want that assessment to occur across all grade levels and all categories of students. So I think we should be expecting to find out an uneven, you know, impact on students. We might find that some elementary students, for example, are doing fine. We might find upper elementary, middle school students really struggling. You know, it's going to be hard to tell. But the first thing we sort of put in place was this planning process, and the first phase of that is a needs assessment. And that information should be coming back to us in the next couple of weeks, so we'll be able to look at sort of the broader pattern statewide and assist districts with focusing on their interventions accordingly. But it's no doubt going to be a real issue, I think it's fair to say. You know, when you point to the national information, we have districts in the country that haven't been open at all, so there's going to be significant work to do in the area of academics and learning support for students, for sure.
There's been talk about a summer remedial program. Would we expect to see those in Vermont?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we've announced, the governor's been formed a team around that. We've, you know, trying to pull together resources, particularly to help those places where they don't have access to as many programs as others. But I think also importantly, I just want to heighten sort of the first phase of sort of this recovery work will be around re-engaging students. So we really want the summer to be engaging. We want every student to have something to do, whether it be a job or an after-school summer program, recreational type thing, but we want to re-engage with all students and get them reconnected so we can begin to sort of do that recovery work. But I think summer after-school programs, those types of things are going to be really critical in the coming months and year as we seek to sort of start to carve a path forward from the pandemic.
Have we been furnishing the traditional standardized tests so we have a more concrete sense of how students are doing? Or some of those, I think, were suspended, weren't they?
Yeah, the national sort of testing requirement in Vermont that manifests itself, what we call SBAC, the Standard Smarter Balanced Assessment, was waived or shut down nationally last spring due to the pandemic. This spring, we are going to hold it. The federal government, the Biden administration, is requiring us to hold the testing. There'll be a waiver, however, for some of the accountability provisions. So on the one hand, I think it's going to be useful to have some data, but we just have to be very cautious about what we do with it, since our students have experienced a variety of learning modalities throughout the year. So I think the news there will be some information, but we just have to be cautious about its validity and what we do with it.
We're chatting with Dan French, the Secretary of Education, and Dan, again, referring to some national reports, I always assume things are better in Vermont. I think generally that's a fair assumption. But there are very troubling stories about kids just disappearing, not logging on to their remote learning, not showing up for class to a degree that's greater than normal levels of truancy. To what extent have we experienced that?
Yeah, I think it's a very significant concern, and I tend to focus just on our Vermont issues, and it's an issue in Vermont for sure. The way we sort of structured our recovery planning process for districts was in three focus areas, and one of them I've spoken to a bit already is the academic area, sometimes considered the more obvious one. But the two other focus areas, one of them is mental health and social emotional well-being. We know pre-pandemic that many of our students had heightened levels of anxiety and so forth, and no doubt there's a lot more of that today. We're all a little more anxious than we were. But the third focus area has to do with this area of engagement, and again, why summer school, after-school type activities are going to be so critical and probably a precondition to really start to begin to assess the impact in the other areas, including academics. But the issue of truancy, for example, sort of falls into that domain. So we want districts to reestablish those connections, and we'll be looking at the state level for patterns in that, and then be bringing other state resources, departments, and so forth to bear to help, including DCF or mental health and so forth. So I fully expect to have a focused conversation on truancy and attendance issues. But I think, you know, on the other hand, not to dismiss our own challenges in Vermont, but we haven't really seen the whole like populations dropping out as we've seen more broadly in some of our more urban school districts in the country. So, but we have our own issues, and we'll have to craft our own solutions to help support students.
Well, that's why you get the big bucks. We appreciate your being on the case there. And thanks so much, Dan French, Secretary of Education, for spending time with us this morning to talk about it. It's a matter of interest to all of our communities, all our families and kids, and we certainly hope that we'll be back to some semblance of normalcy in the not-too-distant future in our schools. So best of luck in your work to make that happen.
Yeah, well, thank you very much. I mean, it's great to work in a state that puts such a priority on education. It's been wonderful.
Well, thanks, Dan, and we're going to pause for some news and come back after the top of the hour with June Tierney, the Commissioner of Public Service, and later in the program, Lindsay Curley, the Secretary of Commerce and Community Development, to talk about more parts of the ARPA rollout, the $1 billion that's coming to Vermont from the federal government. This is Vermont Viewpoint.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings, and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall-winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Jim Douglas sitting in today for Rick, and we're delighted to have you with us. We had some great conversations during the last hour with Julie Moore, the Secretary of Natural Resources, and Dan French, the Secretary of Education. And we're looking forward to chatting during this half hour with June Tierney, the Commissioner of Public Service. Before we get to our conversation with June, though, let me bring to your attention a media advisory that just came out from the governor's office a short time ago. And ordinarily, as I'm sure you know, because you're tuned 24/7 to WDEV, that on Tuesday and Friday, Governor Scott has his COVID-19 response press conference at 11 o'clock. Well, today it's going to be at noon because at 11 a.m., the governor, Secretary Mike Smith, Commissioner Dr. Levine, and others are going to be on a conference call with other governors and White House officials about the news this morning regarding the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. There'll be folks probably from the CDC and FDA on the call as well. So the governor's going to defer his semi-weekly press conference that would ordinarily come to you on WDEV at 11 o'clock till 12 noon today. So plan accordingly, and but of course keep listening because there'll be some great programming at 11 o'clock this morning, as there always is on Radio Vermont. Well, we're chatting now with June Tierney, the Commissioner of the Department of Public Service. Commissioner, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, such a pleasure to be here, Governor. Thank you.
Well, you're going to be playing an important role in the rollout of ARPA, the billion-plus dollars that has come to Vermont or will be coming to Vermont through the latest stimulus program that the Congress has approved. And a great deal of it, about a quarter of it, I guess, is related to areas within your bailiwick, and that is connectivity in various forms, making sure that we can communicate with one another. You know, governors have been talking about that for a long time, but darn, we still have these challenges, I guess, in a rural state like Vermont. But tell us about what your plans are for using these resources and building out our broadband and other networks.
Well, Governor, a couple things really caught my attention. What you just said are this. One, you shouldn't feel bad that multiple governors have made promises of this nature over the years, because what we lose sight of is that the goalposts keep changing too. When we first embarked on this journey to provide universal connectivity in Vermont, folks would have been excited to get DSL connectivity. And then that quickly turned into, you know, wanting to have 25.3 speed of broadband, which is the federal definition of high-speed broadband. And now increasingly the focus is on getting fiber out there because there's a recognition that we need to build once, not multiple times. And this money that we have right now is our best opportunity in years to do exactly that. So it's not that, folks haven't had plans or good intentions or the right priorities. It's that the money hasn't been there, but it's here now. And the priority is to spend it wisely. And from Governor Scott's perspective, as I'm sure you heard with my colleagues before, the idea is to make capital investments with the money. And, it might sound at first like that's coming at the expense of focusing on people, but that's not so because every one of the capital investments that are targeted with this money by the Scott administration plan, and specifically in my area, directly go to helping people. If you get folks access to broadband, you've opened up the world of telehealth and telework and teleeducation, participating in civic activities from your home instead of going to a select board meeting to be there in person, that sort of thing. It opens up a world of opportunity to include bringing folks to the state. And so the idea is to, for us to prioritize in getting to the vision of universal broadband for everyone that is future-proof forever, you have to have certain goals that get you there. And the first goal for the Scott administration is that we get everybody connected. And that means, in this case, the folks who are underserved or not served at all with broadband, they're going to be the priority in this spend. And if you have, 25.3 or less at this time at an address, this plan prioritizes getting you fiber to the home, 100 up, 100 down. So that's the first part of what I wanted to say. And the second part is it's not just the administration's plan. This is a conversation that has to be shared by all stakeholders, and the department's been working really hard to do that over the last year and a half. We started with an emergency broadband action plan that we took around the state to any number of different stakeholders to say, what do you think of this plan? And the first half of that plan was pretty much enacted into law last year, and we had a number of successes with our line extension program, for instance, and getting out connectivity initiative grants that built fiber to folks in various parts of the state in very short time in order to at least get as many people as we could connected during the pandemic who were not connected. And then the second half of that plan that we were taking around the state had to do with how to appropriate sizable dollars that I anticipated, frankly, and the governor anticipated and other leaders anticipated would be coming our way from the federal government in light of this terrible event that the nation's been through. And we spent the better part of last year, working out what would be a proposal that works for everybody. And, of course, as always happens with public policy issues that are of great interest, many different people have many different points of view. And so the Scott administration's point of view is let's take care of those who are unconnected or who are connected in a substandard fashion first. Let's get them the best broadband that we can get them. And more importantly, let's listen to what other people are saying, too, and see if we can find that center that everybody can agree on and how to spend this money. Sorry about that long-winded answer, Governor, but you gave me my reins, and I ran.
Well, that's fine. It's important for our listeners to know. We're chatting with June Tierney, the Commissioner of Public Service, about connectivity and using these new federal stimulus dollars to build out our broadband network. I remember in the old days, meaning, when I was in state government, we talked about the challenge of such a rural topographically challenged state where there's somebody in a nook and cranny or a dell or up a long mountain road where extending service would be prohibitively expensive. But I think I hear you say with these resources, we're going to literally provide service to everybody.
That is the idea is that everybody is going to have service. Keep in mind that many Vermonters, as we speak, do have service. Most. And these dollars are not necessarily targeted at them. These dollars are targeted at folks who have something less than 25.3 as we speak. They're considered underserved or unserved. And for those nooks and cranny parts, that's a very important part of the discussion, Governor Douglas, because that's where we have to come to agreement as, you know, Vermonters at large as to whether we are willing to accept that in some locations in our state, stringing fiber is prohibitively expensive. And so perhaps that isn't our first priority. Perhaps a different kind of technology we'll need to serve. And then the question becomes, who makes those decisions? And that's a conversation that's underway in the legislature right now. And the governor is listening, and as his commissioner, I'm very keen to hear what the answer is ultimately.
I'm sure you can make some progress because, what, about 10% of our population is underserved at this point. And so I'm sure you
precisely.
Can.
Precisely. Yeah. And that's been one of the good news stories of the last year is that we were able to take funding that was not anywhere in view when the pandemic first broke, and we were able to cut into that number. The conventional number has been 70,000 addresses, 60,000 addresses. We've been whittling that down, and now we're at a place where what we're targeting with this money is roughly 53,000 addresses. So that's 7,000 that just in the space of a year we were able to get service to, or at least make it available to folks, and that's a huge success.
That's great progress. One aspect of this has been confusing to me, frankly. There are CUDs, or Communication Union Districts, around the state, and I gather they'll be the grantees of these resources. But is there also a private component, private entities that are involved in the rollout? How does that work?
Yeah, I'm really glad you asked that question because that's actively being debated as we speak. And the proposal the governor has set out is kind of agnostic on the point. The proposal that he released earlier this week, I think, or late last week, was that, you know, there are basically two scenarios. Both involve these CUDs. And when we're talking about these CUDs, they're not abstractions. Those are, you know, north of 300 volunteers in Vermont who are giving enormous amounts of their time in addition to their full-time jobs. Joining in the governance of these CEDs that now pretty much cover the entire state. And that has happened over the last year and a half alone. You know, just I think 2 years ago, we had two CEDs in Vermont, you know, EC Fiber, and we had a Central Vermont Fiber as well. And of them all, EC Fiber is the CED model that is at this point launched as a you know, flourishing business, if you will. But it is a communications union district made up of a board of folks who, you know, are doing this because they're public-spirited folks who are spending their time and trying to get their community the connectivity they need. And that pretty much describes all of the CUDs who are at different stages at this point of trying to follow in the footsteps of EC Fiber. And they are certainly the very important vehicle through which I expect these dollars are going to be administered. But one of the other options in the governor's plan, in addition to granting funds to a CED to build its own network, is for a CED to also enter into a private-public partnership. And in that instance, I think that partner can be any number of different counterparties, provided that they're, you know, bringing value to the table, which here would be realizing that vision of getting the unconnected connected. And so in those partnerships, I fully expect that there could be existing ISPs or electric cooperatives, you know, counterparts like that, to work with a CUD. And in turn, that relationship could be anything from a CUD hiring one of those internet service providers as a vendor to do the construction of a system. It could be the CUD hiring them to operate the system. It could also be the CUD entering into a binding agreement where that entity agrees to be guided by the CUD in terms of assessing what the community needs are. Now, one of the issues under discussion right now is, should those private entities, like a small telephone company, for instance, should they be able in their own right to make application for funds and completely bypass the CUDs? And that's, you know, one of the issues under discussion right now. And from my point of view, I welcome that conversation. I think it's been a long time coming. I think some accommodation could be made if that is where the conversation ultimately lands. And that's why it's so important that this not become a, you know, my view or the highway situation, but rather that folks come together and say, okay, what can we agree makes the best sense here?
Well, I remember Ronald Reagan once famously said, it doesn't really matter who gets the credit if you get the job done. And I hope that'll be the perspective that folks will take on this.
Well, I sure agree with you there, Governor. I think there's way too little of that anymore. And we desperately need to bring that perspective back. And I think Governor Scott does a great job of leading in exactly that direction. He's exhibited that during the pandemic. And I think, I'm sure that that will be the governing principle going forward with this funding as well.
And there's one specific project I saw on the plan, that is to keep the libraries connected. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. It's a small piece of money, but, it's that kind of detail that is so important in Vermont. That is a small network up in the Northeast Kingdom. It was launched in the 2010 timeframe, I think, using a grant from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. And it has been a lifeline for the folks up in the Kingdom. And it's the kind of thing that needs to be supported. It needs to be reinforced as we do this this larger build-out, because folks depend on that network for their connectivity, which is precisely why so many of the folks we're trying to reach need to be the priority with this funding.
And another part, Commissioner, of your mission is wireless communication. So tell us about how this will help build out more telecommunications connectivity in Vermont.
Well, I think the most important part about that component of the proposal is that it's on the radar screen and provision's been made for it. The governor's budgeting something in the neighborhood of $25 million as a pot of dollars to be used when the 10-year telecom plan is finished. The work on that plan is underway right now, and it's due to be delivered to the legislature earlier this summer, in, I think, June 30 or thereabouts. And in that work that we're doing, the issue of wireless communication is being reviewed to see, what can we do as a state in setting a vision and sending the right signals to the market players who overwhelmingly control our wireless infrastructure here in the state of Vermont. We like to think of it in terms of Vermont's wireless systems, our cell systems. But the truth is that those systems are private property that belong to companies that control their own destiny and their pace and location of investment. So it's a tricky thing to deal with cell service in the state as a state agency. It's something we don't have jurisdiction over as regulators. But this $25 million is set aside to see, to the extent there are recommendations in this plan for strategies the state could be pursuing, that there's some seed money for that.
Well, I recall chatting with the CEO of Verizon once upon a time, and the message was clear that he wanted to be helpful, but it's not exactly cost-effective to build out a network in some parts of Vermont because it's so rural and unprofitable. So it's a real challenge, and we hope the plan that comes out later this year and the federal resources will move us in the right direction there. I was amused, well, I guess not amused, but interested a year or so ago when your department called out these cell phone providers for claiming that there's more coverage in Vermont than there really is, because I used to come back to the office and I'd look at those maps and I'd say, well, there is not coverage there. I was just there this morning.
That was a good piece of work, and it had quite a bit of impact at the national level, and other states have turned to it as well. And in fact, those who are last to become first, when we first did that work, it was noted in a dissent by Commissioner Rosenworcel at the Federal Communications Commission in one of the very important opinions that the Federal Communications Commission released just, I think, a year and a half ago about the future of cell service in rural parts of the United States. And today that same commissioner is now the acting chair of the FCC, and she took note of our work, and it was a simple but effective way of truth grounding, if you will, those representations on paper. It's a very Yankee kind of approach where you just take a straightforward proposition. Oh, your map says there's coverage. Well, let's hit the road and let's see if that's so. Oh, who knew it isn't? But more, you know, to get a little bit into the weeds here, I think it's important to understand that those coverage maps that the companies have, they are the product of algorithms, of planning tools, of desktop exercises, and the like. And from where they're sitting and making investment decisions about dollars in their plant, those tools are adequate for their purposes. But they result in these kinds of inaccuracies. And for a little state like Vermont, the inaccuracy was devastating because the maps that the companies were producing purported to show that we were completely covered. What's the problem? We don't need to do anything more in Vermont. And clearly, Vermonters or folks visiting us for that matter know firsthand that that's not so. So yes, we were pleased to do that, and that project sort of highlights the tension I'm talking about, because as regulators, we can go out there and we can develop the facts that show, hey, we really need something, but we don't have the requisite tools to say to a Verizon or to an AT&T, and you shall do something about it. Mm-hmm. But we are setting aside $25 million in the hopes that we can do something with those funds to see if we can at least get the roads that need coverage the most, some kind of coverage through, again, public-private partnership of some kind. But that does remain to be determined.
Well, I was really pleased to see you document it. My anecdotes weren't sufficient, but when you...
You led the way with the anecdotes, because over time, you're right, as people want to see what's behind an anecdote. And it was a basic, I'm an old white-collar crime attorney, defense attorney, that is, and it was just basic developing your evidence to make your case, you know?
Well, I'm sure glad you did. That's great. June Tierney is the Commissioner of Public Service. We're talking about building out broadband and telecom infrastructure. One of the challenges with wireless service, of course, is putting up towers, because they're not perhaps the most attractive infrastructure in a community. Do you think you'll be able to do that in ways that we'll get the service we need?
Well, I think you've put your finger perfectly on a quintessential issue that bedevils Vermont. We're constantly trying to find that balance between the natural beauty of our landscape, that is also an engine for our economic life here, and also trying to make sure that we have the benefit of prime communication in our state, the facilities for that. And Governor Scott's been very clear that for him, there's also a real need to respect the will of the community. And that's the approach that the department's been taking on my watch, to, treat every case as a case on its own merits, recognizing the imperative of getting that tower put up so that there can be good communication, but also listening to a community when it says, does it have to be there? Couldn't it be, half mile over? Does it have to be there? We already have two other towers in this area, two different services. Couldn't they co-locate? And I have to say that a lot of the companies have been pretty good about modifying their plans when that community sentiment becomes known to them. And that's really something I credit our public advocacy division with, that they've done an outstanding job of being at the center of those conversations and making sure they happen, and making constructive change in projects when it can be done.
Well, sometimes you can find a creative way to do it. Our church in Middlebury hosts several antennae in our steeple, for example, and there are silos that have antennas on them. So sometimes you can find a way to make it work.
Yeah, I would go so far as to say a lot of the time that's exactly what we've been doing. Every once in a while that case comes along that grabs a headline and really points to the tension. But, there are plenty of cases that never register where those adjustments were made. And that's really Vermont is finding that balance between the aesthetics of their environment. And I should also add, for the folks who have concerns about health and safety, at times, those are the issues that get worked out at the local state level through those conversations. And I think that's a core function of the Department of Public Service and the Public Advocacy Division.
June, we want to be realistic about expectations. How long will it take, do you think, to expand the wireless and broadband service that we've been discussing?
No, I think realism is absolutely important, because Vermonters expect that of us. And I think just as they expect us to be bold and to lead, with clear vision. For instance, several years ago, the legislature adopted fiber to the premises throughout the state by 2024 goal, and that's in statute. You know, here it is at 2021, and that's a very tall order that I think it's fair to say is not going to be met. But it provided the impetus for momentum for people to be reaching and stretching and trying to get there, and so that's very important. One of the things that we're going to have to deal with is the fact that Vermont isn't the only state that's getting sizable federal dollars for a build-out, whether it's broadband or other forms of connectivity. The other 49 states are doing that, too. And there has been for quite some time a labor shortage, not just, that there aren't enough lines people, for instance, and that there is also a material shortage, that there's not enough fiber. In the labor shortage area, that's a generational thing where for a good 15 years now, utilities have been sounding the alarm that the next generation isn't coming along at the pace that we need them to have enough folks to do that work.
And June, we're out of time, unfortunately, but we're going to have to take a news break. But thanks so much for being with us this morning. June Tierney, the Commissioner of Public Service. This is Vermont Viewpoint.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall-winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. Jim Douglas sitting in this morning, and we're going to be chatting in just a moment with Secretary Lindsey Curley of the Agency of Commerce and Community Development. Before we do that, though, a couple of items from the newswire. Governor Scott's normal semi-weekly press conference that occurs on Tuesday and Friday at 11 o'clock will be at noon today instead of 11 because he and folks on his team need to be on a call with other governors and the White House to talk about the Johnson & Johnson announcement from the FDA and CDC this morning. There was, as I'm sure many of our listeners know, a report that the one-dose J&J vaccine could, in rare cases, be linked to blood clotting, and there has been one reported fatality. About 7 million Americans have received the J&J vaccine, including Governor Scott, so it'll be interesting to hear what he has to say about it. But one thing he has said is on Twitter this morning that he is suspending the J&J vaccine clinics in Vermont. So those who were scheduled for appointments today will be contacted to reschedule, and the governor will have more to say, I'm sure, at noon. Be sure to stay tuned here to complete live coverage on WDEV so that you have the latest information on that developing story. So again, a 1 hour delay in the governor's regular press conference from 11 to today. It'll be at 12 noon, and a suspension of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine clinics in Vermont. So if you were scheduled to have a vaccine today, you'll be contacted by the provider and rescheduled. Well, a lot going on. Lindsey Curley, Secretary of Commerce and Community Development, thanks for being on the show.
I'm glad to be here with you this morning.
Well, you've got an extra hour to prepare for that press conference today, I guess.
Yes, for sure. That's a little gift to get another hour in my day.
Well, we hope the matter is resolved positively here in the not too distant future. But we want to chat about ARPA, American Recovery Plan Act that appropriated over $1 billion to Vermont, a lot of it appropriately for economic development and housing areas within your agency's responsibility. But give us a sense, Lindsey, about how Vermont's economy has fared during this pandemic. It's certainly been a challenge for a lot of our business owners and employees, but just kind of set the stage before we talk about the recovery efforts.
Absolutely. We early on in this pandemic, we were chatting with a variety of Vermont business owners, and in the first 30 days, you know, we were seeing impact of over $300 million, and that continued to grow, you know, exponentially. And, you know, thankfully, we received federal stimulus through the COVID coronavirus relief fund. And so with the help of the legislature, we built grant programs and found a way to get money into the hands of businesses and landlords and to try to help folks survive through this really difficult time. So, you know, I think it's still a little bit soon to tell whether, you know, how that worked entirely. We're definitely seeing higher revenue than what we forecasted in the state government. But overall, I think, you know, we need a little more time to know exactly what's happening. I continue to talk with business owners regularly, and, you know, even those who were fortunate to receive either the federal payroll protection program grant or the economic injury disaster loan grant or state grants that I just talked about through this program, some of them may financially have the money and feel a bit secure, but they continue to feel very stressed in terms of the operating environment. We're still not out of this pandemic, and so this is ongoing, and we continue to have some challenges, but overall feeling really positive about what we did accomplish over the past year.
Well, that's good. Let's hope the end of the tunnel is in sight. We have stories like the J&J pause this morning, variants, and you never know, but at least we seem to be on a positive track now, and I think Vermonters are ready for a break, right?
Yes.
So let's talk about ARPA. A lot of the $1 billion that's coming from the Congress will go to your or through your agency for economic development initiatives. Give us a sense of how you expect to deploy those resources.
Absolutely. You know, this pandemic and the ARPA have given Vermont a really unique opportunity to rebuild from the ground up. And in our agency, as you mentioned, we're overseeing economic development and housing proposals our administration has put forth to the legislature for consideration. And, you know, these proposals were built on what we learned as we have traveled around the state prior to COVID with the Governor's Capital for a Day program, where we went into communities as an extended cabinet and listened to those communities and learned about what they need. And over time, we kept hearing the same themes. It was broadband, water and sewer, housing and childcare. Those were all barriers for them in terms of recruiting people to their businesses and to their towns. And so we have this opportunity now to make significant investments, and the ones in economic development will be to extend to small businesses and you know, enable this, as I mentioned, the creating capacity. And one part of the economic development plan is related to more, if we call it economic recovery bridge grants. So many Vermonters have heard about the economic recovery grants that we did in July through September, where Vermont businesses could apply for grant funds to help them survive. And we were able to, I think on average, we were able to replace about 47% of lost revenue broadly over Vermont businesses. So we knew that there was continued unmet need. And again, as this pandemic goes on longer, that need grows more. So one piece of this proposal is $50 million, an allocation that we're asking for to replenish the economic recovery bridge grants program. And it's specifically targeted to provide financial assistance to businesses who've been unable to access state and federal aid, or businesses that were unable to access a second round of the federal grant because of eligibility requirements, or businesses that just haven't received adequate funding or financial assistance relative to their losses to date. So that's one piece that, you know, we're hopeful we can replenish that fund. It would be very important to us. Another aspect of the proposal is a capital grants fund, and we're proposing $90 million over 3 years to provide capital funding to businesses and communities, outdoor recreation destinations that Vermont's been unable to fund at an impactful level in the past. this capital investment program would be used to fund priority shovel-ready capital projects across the state in every region. And it would be done through a competitive grant process. But again, it would be very impactful dollars that would be used to incentivize public-private partnerships. And again, we have some really exciting projects that would bring something positive to every single region in our state. And then the final piece of the economic development proposal is expedited permitting. So we're proposing $3 million over 3 years to support the Agency of Natural Resources in prioritizing these ARPA-funded projects that because we have a shortened timeline, because it's federal dollars, they give us a deadline, we want to make sure that we get these projects, these you know, shovel-ready projects going and not held up by the permitting process. So we will give priority projects will be prioritized for, like, downtowns and village centers, new town centers, neighborhoods, designated areas, and existing industrial parks. So very exciting opportunities on the, you know, economic development side. I'll take a breath here and let you ask questions on that before I move on to the housing.
Well, exciting, especially because, as you indicated, a lot of the federal and state grant programs sometimes have rules and constraints and eligibility requirements that don't apply to everybody. So the kind of flexibility you've described will certainly be helpful to a lot of businesses around the state. And on the expedited permitting, frankly, I hope you can make that permanent. That's something we've been working on for a long time to try to move things along, because that's a competitive challenge for Vermont. Other states seem to be more expeditious. So some good priorities, Lindsay, and good luck with getting them going. And I assume that businesses will know how to apply for them through your agency or through the regional development corporations. How will that work?
Yeah, absolutely. So we have created such a great network to disseminate information around the state throughout this crisis. And, you know, it's again, if we're looking for silver linings here, I think, you know, the Agency of Commerce has connected with more businesses more broadly throughout this pandemic than we ever have before. So we have created newsletters that go out a couple times a week. We've done weekly webinars. Again, we've worked with our partners, the regional development corporations, the regional planning commissions, the SBDC, the SBA. I mean, I know there's a lot of acronyms here, but so many the lenders, right, the banks and the credit unions, but a variety of folks to help us get this information out. So, you know, if we can get this $50 million approved, we absolutely will let Vermonters know how to apply for that and what the eligibility requirements are. But we feel, again, really good about the network that we've created throughout this pandemic in order to communicate with folks.
That's great. Well, let's talk about housing. That's a key element, actually a larger one in terms of the dollar allocation.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, $249 million that is proposed to bring 5,000 housing units online in the next 4 years. And, you know, again, when we have traveled around the state and listened to business owners who have talked about recruitment and trying to get their workforce in place, you know, they've said that housing is a large barrier. So, you know, many people recognize that we have a need to address the homelessness and at-risk individuals and families, which that's absolutely covered in this proposal. And on top of that, we want to make sure that we incentivize developers to bring vacant housing, you know, or rundown housing stock back online and make that available for people. We also know that there's a strong demand for new homes, and so we've created a program to help new home development as well. And, you know, what we're doing in this is we're using methods and programs that have worked really well in the past, and again, funding them and building them out so that they can really speak to our needs right now. And as I mentioned, you know, we have a variety of people who have been living in hotels during this crisis, and we need to make sure that we give them permanent housing solutions, and at the same time recognizing that you know, people want to come to Vermont. They want to take great jobs here, or maybe they want to come here and work remotely. But if a working family can't find a home that is suitable for them, then we lose them to another state. So we're really, again, excited about the opportunity for these housing initiatives.
Well, and your permitting initiative will be helpful in that as well. So all ties together, doesn't it?
Yeah, and you know, I know you spoke with Secretary Moore earlier, and again, you know, some of the infrastructure, the wastewater infrastructure, is needed for many of these communities to either attract, you know, a employer to their community or build houses, right, and build, you know, the very much needed housing that we need. So it does all tie together. And the broadband, you just spoke with Commissioner Tierney, that all ties in as well. You know, folks, that when they come here, they want to make sure they have access to reliable broadband. Businesses need it as well. So it all really does tie together. And again, I mean, this is a once in a lifetime unique opportunity to really create capacity.
Well, in one sense, let's hope it's only once in a lifetime, right?
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Well, Lindsay, we've got to take a break. Got to pay the bills for the show. And so we'll be back in just a couple of moments. So we're chatting today with Lindsay Curley, the Secretary of Commerce and Community Development. We'll be right back.
WDEV Studios are sponsored by Formula Ford Truckland. See the all-new 2021 redesigned F-150 and the 2021 Bronco Sport at FormulaFordVT.com today.
Hi, this is Almy from the Waterbury Public Library. What does the Waterbury Library lend these days? You know we have books, but did you know we also lend snowshoes, sizes from kid to adult, ukuleles, puzzles, a telescope, designer cake pans for special occasions, a vegetable slicer and spiralizer, a food mill, think apple and tomato sauce, a small loom, happy lights for chasing away the winter blues, a kilowatt household meter, a wood moisture meter, and passes to area museums and attractions. All of these items can be reserved and picked up during our curbside service hours. Call the library at 244-7036 to reserve, or put an item on hold by logging into your library account. Go to www.waterburypubliclibrary.com and start checking things out.
Spring is springing. There's still plenty of snowpack, so good reason to visit the Mad River Valley. While you're here, make a stop at the almost world-famous Warren's Store. Newly renovated, delicious deli offerings and world-class bakery. Online ordering now available. You must be ready to ditch those COVID sweatpants. We've got some cute, comfy, casual clothing upstairs at the Warren Store from some of your favorite brands. Free People, Z Supply, and Tribal, to name a few. Fall winter clothing is still on sale, so head on down to Warren Village. Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. WarrenStore.com.
New to podcast or looking for some variety to add to your current rotation? Check out the selection of locally and nationally produced podcasts on the WDEV website. You'll find podcasts of WDEV's own Vermont Viewpoint with Rick Sengary, Travels with Charlie, For the Birds, Healthcare Today, and The Brady Farkas Show. In addition, you can access podcasts from ESPN and CBS, all for free. Find the complete selection of podcasts at WDEVradio.com.
Welcome back. Jim Douglas sitting in today on Vermont Viewpoint. And a couple of programming notes. We told you earlier in the hour that the governor's COVID-19 response press conference has been moved today from 11 o'clock to noon. And so you've probably been wondering, well, what's going to happen between 11 and 12 o'clock on WDEV? And the answer is Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. Bill is always ready, standing by, ready to bring his important perspective and those of his guests onto the airwaves. So today, some of the Ethan Allen Institute gang, Matthew Strong, Rob Roper, and David Fleming, will join Bill to talk about proposed legislation that may reduce our ability to detect and prove election fraud, making it more tempting. They wonder, will it reduce confidence and trust in the outcome of elections, at least among those whose candidates are unsuccessful? They'll talk about the importance of election integrity and how we might achieve the right balance between making it easier to vote once, but difficult to vote more than once. So that's what's coming up at 11 o'clock today on Common Sense Radio. And if you didn't hear the other news bulletin that we brought you earlier, Governor Scott, through a tweet, has suspended the Johnson & Johnson vaccine clinics in Vermont, at least for today. So if you have a scheduled appointment for J&J jab today, you'll be contacted about rescheduling it. So a lot going on, and we've got some time remaining with Lindsey Curley, the Secretary of Commerce and Community Development. And Lindsey, you've outlined some of the areas of responsibility that you'll be involved in with the ARPA funds that are coming to Vermont. And you also noted that we chatted with a couple of your colleagues earlier and how all this ties together. And one area that Secretary Moore mentioned was outdoor recreation. And obviously, your agency is responsible for tourism in Vermont, an important element of our economic base. So I'd be interested in your thoughts about how these resources will help help us with recreation programs. Heaven knows Vermonters want to get outside, don't they?
They sure do, and I'm so glad you brought up outdoor recreation. You know, this pandemic and even prior to, we were seeing such a drive for the outdoor recreation market in our state, and, you know, folks want to come to Vermont and recreate in our beautiful hills and valleys, and so yeah, we have an opportunity here again to invest in the outdoor recreation, and you know, just as an example, we want to bolster the experience, the user experience along the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail, for example. So last year we were fortunate to receive additional funding to finish building out the trail, but now we have an opportunity to create, you know, this user experience along the way with signage, Wayfair signage, some history about the area. And the trail runs along 18 communities. And so we are proposing infrastructure that would connect the trail to those communities. It might be a sidewalk that's needed, or a bridge, or parking and bike racks. It also could be a parklet in their town, for example, that they might want to entice people to jump off the trail for a break to, you know, shop in their local stores. So, you know, these are opportunities that we have to really make our, you know, again, show people how great our outdoor recreation is here in Vermont, and bolster the experiences and additional opportunities. And as Secretary Moore probably talked about, is also doing some infrastructure upgrades around our, you know, parks around the state as well. So fishing access and a variety of different upgrades. So it's a very exciting time on that front.
Well, I remember the first ceremonial signing of an agreement to get the Lamoille Valley Rail Trail going some 15-ish years ago, and it's really come a long way and will continue to be a great resource for us. Yes, Vermonters want to get outside. I guess a few students maybe overdid it over the last weekend, but that raises another question that I think our listeners might be interested in hearing about, because your agency is the keeper of the rule book, basically, right? You have a website with the governor's executive order provisions and the updates. Just give us a quick rundown on the reopening process, because over the next couple of months, the governor said we're gonna get ready to really celebrate Independence Day on July 4th, right?
Absolutely. So yes, our agency has spent the last year helping businesses and individuals navigate the crisis in terms of how to, you know, provide for in-person business operations in a safe manner, as well as to partner with the health department to educate Vermonters on the risks and give them the tools they need to make decisions about what risks they're willing to accept and in terms of, you know, taking care of their loved ones and protecting our community. So back last week, the governor announced what we call Vermont Forward. So this is what we are using as the final stages of our reopening plan. And as you mentioned, our goal is, you know, to really celebrate on Independence Day. So starting on April 9th, we moved certain sectors, they're mostly outdoor sectors, to what we call universal guidance. And what that means is it's more of a simplified type of guidance. It doesn't remove restrictions, but rather we take away the really detailed sector guidance and we say there are five things that you need to put into place when you're planning the delivery of your business, right? Whether it's a service or you're making a product. And so those five things are stay home if you're sick, wear a mask, ensure 6-foot spaces in uncrowded places, practice good hygiene, and think before you travel. And so when you imagine setting up your, you know, maybe it's your office space, you're bringing your office, your employees back into the office environment, you know, this gives you the idea that you have to allow for 6-foot of space for people. We continue to say stay home if you're sick, wear a mask, be diligent. We're going to just continue to keep opening up over the next couple months. And on May 1st, we'll have another group of sectors that will go into this universal guidance. And also we're allowing for events, weddings and receptions that are, that come behind ceremonies, so to speak, along the ceremonies. So people will have a more broad ability to get out and enjoy things as we have more of our most vulnerable vaccinated.
Well, that's great, Julie. I've been talking with everyone. Lindsay, we've been talking with all your colleagues this morning. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but we're looking forward to being more or less normal by July 4th, right? That'll be great.
That would be great. That would be great. And thank you for having me this morning. It's been my pleasure to chat with you.
Well, best of luck in all your responsibilities, Lindsay Curley, the Secretary of Commerce. Thanks for joining us today. Jim Douglas in for Rick. We'll see you again.